So I want you to think about the last choice you made today. It could be something incredibly minor, like choosing which mug to pour your coffee into this morning, or maybe, you know, deciding which seat to take on the train.
Right. Or just picking up a specific pen from your desk.
Exactly. Just a tiny everyday decision.
Yeah.
I want you to really picture that moment of decision. You reached out, you evaluated your options, you selected an item, and you moved on with your day.
Yeah.
Now ask yourself, was that genuinely your idea? Or were you, you know, nudged?
Wow. Yeah.
Were you carefully, invisibly guided to make exactly that choice, all while feeling completely certain that it was entirely your own free will?
It is it's a profoundly unsettling question when you start pulling at the threads. I mean, we navigate our entire lives operating on this fundamental assumption that we are the sole authors of our actions.
Right. We have to.
We have to, exactly. Otherwise, the cognitive dissonance would just be paralyzing. But the research we are unpacking today, it suggests our authorship is heavily ghostwritten.
Ghostwritten. I'd love that.
Yeah, like we think we're writing a novel, but we're actually just filling in a Mad Libs page where someone else already provided the whole underlying structure.
That is exactly what we're getting into.
Mm.
So, welcome to our deep dive. Today, our mission is to explore the incredibly fascinating and frankly scary science of how our choices can be covertly controlled.
Absolutely.
And we are basing our entire exploration on a groundbreaking research paper. It's titled Mind Control Trick: Magician's Forcing and Free Will.
Mm.
And this was authored by psychologists Alice Pahes and Gustav Kuhn from Goldsmiths, University of London. So we're going to look under the hood of your brain to see exactly how it gets hacked.
And we're looking at it using the tools of the people who have been hacking it for centuries, right?
Yeah.
Magicians.
Magicians, which sounds wild, but it's real science.
It really is. The scientific community has recently had this massive realization regarding magicians, because for a long time, you know, cognitive psychology operated strictly within the sterile environment of the laboratory.
Right. Very controlled.
Exactly. Very controlled, very clinical. But magicians have essentially been running unregulated, highly motivated cognitive psychology experiments in the real world for hundreds of years.
Just trial and error on stage.
Exactly. Through trial and error, they've empirically discovered the absolute limits and blind spots of human perception, attention, and decision making. They mapped these vulnerabilities way before we had like fMRI machines or formal psychological models like predictive coding.
That's crazy to think about.
Right. So Pahes and Kuhn are basically taking the magician's toolkit and running it through the rigorous framework of modern neuroscience to really map the architecture of human agency.
Okay, so to start, the entire paper centers around this foundational concept in magic called a force.
Right.
But let's clarify what that means, you know, outside the realm of just pulling a rabbit out of a hat.
Yeah.
A force, as defined by these researchers, is a technique that covertly influences a person's choice without their awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And reading through the paper, there are two mandatory components that elevate a force from a simple parlor trick to a profound psychological manipulation.
And that first component is pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, exactly. First, the technique has to significantly affect the spectator's decision or the ultimate outcome. Like the magician has to actually load the dice and get the result they want.
Right. The outcome manipulation is just the mechanical part. But the second component is the psychological marvel.
The really interesting part.
Exactly. The spectator must feel completely, unequivocally free in their choice. They have to believe they are in total control of the outcome they receive.
Because if they don't, the trick just fails.
If a spectator feels forced, the trick fails. But more importantly, the psychological illusion shatters. You have to manufacture an illusory feeling of freedom.
An illusory feeling of freedom.
Yeah. The subject has to genuinely believe they were the architect of the decision.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this is where the psychology gets wildly interesting. The researchers dive into this phenomenon called confabulation.
Oh, yes, confabulation.
And we see this all the time in cognitive science.
Right.
But seeing it applied to magic is staggering. Confabulation is essentially your brain inventing a narrative to explain something it doesn't understand.
Right.
And then completely believing its own fiction. Like when the researchers forced a choice on participants, say, pushing them toward a specific playing card,
mm-hmm.
and then they asked those participants why they chose that card, The participants didn't just shrug or say, I don't know, my hand just went there.
No, they never do.
They confidently invented highly specific reasons entirely unrelated to the magician's covert influence.
And that confabulation aspect is the most revealing part of the dynamic because it exposes the mechanics of what we call illusory agency.
Illusory agency.
So, yeah, it is not merely that people are fooled by, like, a sleight of hand. Their brains actively dynamically construct a completely false narrative of free will in real time.
Yeah.
Just to make sense of the outcome.
Wow.
The brain essentially looks at the result, you know, I am holding the seven of hearts, and it reverse engineers a justification. It's like a retroactive justification.
Exactly. It decides, well, I must have wanted the seven of hearts because it's my lucky number, or because it stood out to me, or because I subconsciously prefer the color red.
That is so wild.
The human brain just abhors a vacuum of agency. It will fabricate a complex, entirely fictional rationalization rather than admit it was manipulated by environmental factors.
It's like scrolling through a streaming service and believing you freely chose a movie, completely ignoring the invisible algorithm that put that specific movie at the exact spot your eye naturally lands.
Yes. That algorithmic curation is the perfect modern equivalent.
Right. Like, you watch it and think, I was really in the mood for a gritty sci-fi thriller tonight. Completely blind to the fact that the platform analyzed your past viewing habits, cross-referenced them with millions of other users, and strategically placed that movie poster in the upper left quadrant of your screen because they knew your eyes would track there first.
Yeah. You feel like you made an autonomous choice, but the environment was aggressively curated to make that choice almost inevitable.
And if we consider the broader implications of this, it really forces us to evaluate our daily lives. In the laboratory or during a magic show, we see brains wonderfully willing to confidently defend choices they didn't actually make.
Yeah.
But out in the real world, we are constantly justifying our purchases, our career paths, the media we consume with these exact same post hoc rationalizations.
We just tell ourselves a story.
We tell ourselves a story of complete autonomy. But the empirical data from Goldsmiths asks us to consider the ratio. Like, how much of our daily action is genuine, spontaneous agency?
Right.
And how much is our brain just vigorously defending a path we were subtly nudged onto by environmental geometry or visual saliency or social pressure we never even consciously registered?
Which naturally brings up the actual mechanics. Like, if a force relies so heavily on hijacking our sense of agency, this desperate biological need we have to feel in control, how exactly does a magician get past our mental security system to plant the choice in the first place?
That's the big question.
So the paper categorizes the first major set of techniques as decision forces.
Right. So a decision force operates right at the moment of choice. The magician directly manipulates the decision-making process itself to dramatically increase the probability of a specific choice being made.
So they aren't guaranteeing it completely.
No, they don't guarantee the outcome with absolute mathematical certainty. There is always a slight margin of error in a decision force.
Mm.
But they are remarkably effective because they exploit the path of least resistance.
So it's classic Kahneman, right?
Right, exactly.
The magician is just weaponizing our system one heuristics against us.
Yeah.
Our brains are efficient, meaning they are inherently lazy.
Yes, very lazy.
If there's a cognitive shortcut, the brain takes it to save metabolic energy.
And the efficiency of the human brain is its greatest vulnerability in this context. Let's look at the visual riffle force detailed in the paper.
Oh, I love this one.
The methodology is deceptively simple, but it relies on really complex visual processing. So the magician takes a deck of cards and riffles through them rapidly in front of the spectator's eyes.
Just flipping through them really fast.
Right. And the instruction is simply to think of a card you see. Unbeknownst to the spectator, the magician manipulates the pacing of the riffle so that the target card is visible for a fraction of a second longer than the others.
But let's dig into the why of that. Because why does a fraction of a second matter?
Good point.
It's not like the spectator consciously thinks, ah, that card was visible for 400 milliseconds, whereas the others were visible for 200 milliseconds, therefore I shall pick it.
No, not at all.
It's about bottom-up visual processing, right? The visual cortex is being bombarded with this rapid, blurry stimuli, and suddenly one frame is held just slightly longer.
Exactly. It breaks the pattern.
Right. It creates a spike in visual saliency. The brain grabs onto the clearest image in the flurry of noise, completely unaware that the clarity was artificially engineered.
And the experimental data on this is striking. Pailez and Kuhn note that depending on whether the performance is live or computer-based, the success rate of the visual riffle force ranges between 30% and 98%.
Right, 98%.
Yes. In live, face-to-face performances, it sits between 54% and 98%. To contextualize that statistical leap, I mean, there are 52 cards in a deck.
Right.
The baseline probability of someone randomly choosing your target card is less than 2%.
Less than 2%, and they get it up to 98.
By manipulating visual processing times below the threshold of conscious awareness, the magician drives that probability up to nearly certainty in some environments.
It bypasses conscious deliberation entirely. You think the card, like, spoke to you, but your visual cortex was just handed the path of least resistance.
Exactly.
But if visual processing is vulnerable, our physical biomechanics are even worse.
Oh, much worse.
The researchers dive into the position force, and this is where the behavioral skew gets almost comical.
It really does.
Imagine sitting at a table. The magician places four identical face-down cards in a horizontal row in front of you, and they say, reach out and touch one.
And the physical setup here is crucial. Four identical options, equidistant from each other, seemingly completely random.
Right.
By pure probability, each card should have a 25% chance of being selected.
But the researchers found that roughly 60% of participants end up selecting the exact same card, the third one from the left.
Yeah.
60%. That is a massive deviation from chance based on nothing more than the layout of the table.
The mechanism driving that 60% is biomechanical efficiency combined with hemispheric dominance.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, the vast majority of the population is right-handed. When a right-handed person is sitting across from a horizontal array of four objects, the third object from the left aligns perfectly with the natural resting position, extension, and trajectory of the right arm. To pick the first or second card requires reaching across the body. To pick the fourth card requires extending the arm further outward.
Right, it's just a tiny bit more effort.
The third card requires the absolute minimum expenditure of motor energy.
So the brain computes the caloric and muscular cost of reaching for each card in milliseconds, finds the cheapest option, and directs the hand there.
Exactly.
All while the conscious mind is busy feeling like a unique individual making a spontaneous choice.
And the disconnect between the physical reality and the conscious perception is the core finding here. When the researchers interviewed the participants who fell for the position force,
yeah,
those individuals significantly underestimated how many other people would choose that exact same card.
They thought they were being unique.
They genuinely believed their choice was idiosyncratic. They were entirely oblivious to the fact that their, quote, spontaneous choice was a highly predictable, stereotypical motor response dictated by the geometry of their own skeleton.
They think they are artists painting a unique canvas, but they are actually just water flowing down the steepest part of a hill.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
But here's the data point that changes everything, I think. The drop-off. The paper notes that when participants are explicitly reminded that they are making a decision.
Yes.
Like when the researcher actively tells them to think carefully about their choice before they move their hand, the selection of that third card plummets from 60% down to 35%.
And that statistical drop reveals the precise operational window of the force. The illusion relies on the participant operating in that automatic, low-effort cognitive state.
The System 1 autopilot.
Exactly. By explicitly reminding the participant to think, the researcher artificially forces the brain out of its heuristic autopilot and engages slower analytical processing.
So the cognitive control overrides the physical bias.
Yes. The brain spends the extra energy to move the arm differently, simply to assert its autonomy.
I have to push back on this a little, though.
Okay, go ahead.
If simply reminding someone they are making a choice cuts the trick's effectiveness almost in half, does that imply our supposed free will is essentially just an unreliable muscle that we keep forgetting to flex?
Mm-hmm.
Are we just walking through life so cognitively depleted that anyone who understands biomechanics can steer our movements as long as they don't explicitly tell us they are doing it?
Well, it implies that cognitive energy is a highly finite resource.
Oh.
And constant vigilance is biologically impossible.
That's true.
We cannot deeply analyze every micro decision, which item to grab from a shelf, which step to take, which card to touch. We must rely on heuristics to function without collapsing from mental exhaustion.
Right.
Magicians and architects of choice in the real world do not invent these biases. They merely map our natural cognitive traffic patterns and place their desired outcomes directly in the busiest intersections.
Blah.
We have the capacity to override the nudges, but the default state of the human animal is to take the easiest road.
Okay, so we are victims of visual flashes and lazy elbows.
Mm-hmm.
But what if the influence is purely conceptual? What if the magician isn't using physical cards or table layouts, but just words? The paper highlights the mental priming force and specifically analyzes the work of the British mentalist Darren Brown.
Ah, yes, Darren Brown. Mental priming shifts the arena from physical biomechanics to the semantic networks within the brain.
Semantic networks.
Yeah. It is the process by which exposure to one stimulus unconsciously influences the response to a subsequent stimulus. The routine analyzed by Pyles and Kuhn involves Darren Brown attempting to make a subject think of a highly specific target.
The Three of Diamonds.
Exactly, the Three of Diamonds.
Let's break down the exact methodology, because watching this routine is like watching a psychological heist. The magician doesn't just walk up and say, name a card. They establish a complex narrative of mental telepathy. They tell the subject, I am going to project a card into your mind. And while they're giving these instructions, their physical movements are a masterclass in compounding subtle cues.
The layering of the primes is essential here. The magician asks the spectator to imagine a screen in their mind, and simultaneously, their hands casually form the shape of a diamond in the air.
Just casually.
Right. And when discussing the numbers on the cards, the magician's fingers subtly trace the number three.
Right.
They might emphasize a point by gesturing with exactly three fingers or by touching three distinct spatial locations on the table. They are continuously bombarding the spectator's subconscious semantic network with the nodes for three and diamond.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The role of the telepathy narrative.
Yes.
The subject completely buys into the premise that they need to act as a psychic receiver. They focus all their conscious energy inward, trying to feel the transmission of the card.
Right.
But that intense inward focus is a massive cognitive misdirection.
Mm.
The conscious brain is so burdened by the impossible task of reading minds that the subconscious is left entirely unguarded. It eagerly soaks up the physical hand gestures and verbal cues because it's desperately looking for any input to solve the task.
And the cognitive load induced by the false narrative is the key to the priming. The overt story masks the covert mechanism, and the empirical results really validate the method. The paper notes that this specific mental priming routine achieves an 18% success rate.
Now, 18% might sound like a failure if you are thinking about stage magic where you want a guaranteed standing ovation.
Sure.
But from a statistical and psychological standpoint, 18% is terrifying.
It is, because the baseline probability of randomly generating the three of diamonds out of 52 possible options is less than 2%.
Right.
Elevating that probability to 18% purely by altering the syntax of your sentences and the casual movement of your hands during a brief conversation, that is a massive statistical anomaly.
It really is.
It demonstrates that the generation of internal thought is highly porous to external environmental framing.
If an entertainer can manipulate the internal generation of a thought, from 2% to 18% just by moving their hands, imagine the implications for a high-stakes business negotiation.
Oh, absolutely.
Imagine sitting in a boardroom. The vendor is pitching a massive software system. They keep verbally leaning on the word streamline. And every time they say efficiency or growth, their body language subtly opens up toward their premium, most expensive package listed on the whiteboard.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't explicitly selling it, but they are aggressively building a semantic bridge in your subconscious. By the time you freely decide which package to recommend to your CEO, you feel like you arrived at the conclusion through pure logical analysis.
And the vulnerability lies in the fact that the influence operates below the threshold of conscious awareness. A person cannot engage their analytical defenses against an influence they do not perceive. However, as effective as decision forces like priming or physical positioning are, they are inherently probabilistic. The magician is tipping the scales heavily, but the spectator still possesses the theoretical ability to choose the wrong card.
They could still mess it up.
Exactly. But the next category of techniques the researchers analyze eliminates that margin of error entirely.
Which brings us to a shift from psychological nudging to outright structural rigging.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when the magician doesn't care what you choose? Because the outcome is a foregone conclusion.
Right.
The paper calls these outcome forces, which rely on the illusion of consequence.
In an outcome force, the spectator's decision is genuinely, undeniably free.
Totally free.
They are not primed. They are not subjected to visual saliency. Their hand is not guided by biomechanical ease. They make a choice. But the architecture of the trick is designed so that their freely made choice has absolutely zero causal impact on the final result.
Zero impact.
The spectator will receive the forced item 100% of the time, regardless of their input.
The first technique analyzed here is the crisscross force, which is a brilliant manipulation of memory and causal logic.
It's so clever.
The setup is simple. The magician places a deck of cards on the table and tells you to cut the deck anywhere you like. You reach out, lift a chunk of cards off the top, and put them down.
Totally free choice.
You chose the exact depth of the cut. It's a completely free choice.
Yeah.
Then the magician takes the bottom half of the deck and places it crossways over the top half, forming an X.
And the next phase of the crisscross force is entirely reliant on the fragility of human working memory.
Yes.
The magician does not immediately proceed. They inject a deliberate time delay. They might ask a distracting question about the spectator's day or tell a quick joke.
Just a few seconds of distraction.
Right. And this temporal gap is crucial because it degrades the spectator's continuous attention and spatial memory of the deck's arrangement.
So after a few seconds, the magician turns back to the deck, lifts the top part of the cross, and points to the top card of the bottom pile. They say, look at the card you cut to. But here's the reality. That card is just the original top card of the entire deck. It was always going to be the top card.
Exactly.
The spectator's act of cutting the deck did absolutely nothing to change the identity of that specific card. Their free choice was a completely meaningless action. Yet, the paper highlights that the vast majority of participants fail to recognize the structural reality of the trick.
And the researchers frame this through the lens of choice blindness, which is the failure of individuals to notice a glaring mismatch between their intended choice and the actual outcome.
Choice blindness.
Yeah. During that time delay, the spectator's raw spatial memory of which pile was the top and which was the bottom decays. When the magician returns to the trick, they provide a verbal post hoc framing, the card you cut to.
Ah.
Because the spectator's internal memory is degraded, they accept the external verbal cue as reality. The magician manufactures a false causal link between the physical action of cutting and the presentation of the forced card.
They literally rewrite the spectator's memory of the immediate past simply by stating a slightly different version of events with authority.
Yes, exactly.
But if the crisscross force weaponizes memory decay, the next technique weaponizes language itself, the equivoque. Or magician's choice. The paper treats this as one of the most insidious methods of forcing.
The equivoque exploits ambiguity blindness and the inherent flexibility of semantics. In a standard setup, the magician places two objects on a table. Let's use a key and a wallet.
Okay, key and wallet.
The magician has predetermined that they will force the key onto the spectator. The instruction given is incredibly brief. Touch one of the objects.
It's an entirely free motor choice. Let's play this out so the listener can hear the trap closing.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's say I am the spectator, and your goal is to force the key on me. I reach out, and I touch the key. What is your response?
I would smile, establish eye contact, and say, excellent. You touched the key, indicating your choice. You keep the key, and I will discard the wallet.
Okay.
You possess the key. The force is a success.
Okay, but what if I do the exact opposite? What if I reach out and touch the wallet? The trick should fundamentally break.
The trick adapts instantly because the rules were never codified. If you touch the wallet, I respond with equal confidence. Excellent. You touch the wallet, indicating the item you want eliminated. I will discard the wallet, leaving you with the key.
Oh.
Regardless of your physical action, the semantic framing shifts to ensure you end up with the key. The outcome is fixed. Only the justification changes.
I am genuinely incredulous on behalf of the listener right now.
It's frustrating, isn't it?
How does a functioning adult brain not immediately catch the semantic flip in the equivoque? If I point to a wallet and you take it away from me, my brain should instantly recognize that the rules of the interaction are logically inconsistent. I should know the game is rigged.
From a pure logic standpoint, your pushback is entirely correct, but human beings do not process real-time interactions through pure logic. We process them through social dynamics.
Social dynamics.
The equivoque succeeds because of ambiguity blindness. The initial instruction, touch one, was purposefully devoid of specific meaning. Because the magician did not define what the act of touching signified before you committed the action, they retained the power to define its significance after the fact.
So because I didn't stop the trick and demand a definition of terms before I move my hand, I implicitly surrender the right to interpret my own action.
Precisely. And this is where linguistic pragmatics and social contracts dictate behavior. To point out the semantic inconsistency, the spectator would have to interrupt the flow of the performance, challenge the authority of the magician, and essentially accuse them of manipulative behavior.
Right, which nobody wants to do.
The social friction, the potential for embarrassment, is incredibly high. So the brain engages in a remarkable act of self-deception. It prioritizes the smooth flow of the social interaction over rigorous logical analysis.
It just plays along.
It retroactively agrees with the magician's interpretation of events to maintain social harmony and preserve the illusion that everything is proceeding normally.
We are so incredibly eager to be polite and so desperate to maintain the social narrative that we will allow someone to actively redefine the meaning of our own physical actions right to our faces.
That's quite something.
We've seen how remarkably vulnerable we are to decision forces, where we are nudged by visual flashes and lazy muscles, and outcome forces, where our choices are rendered completely meaningless by semantic traps.
Great.
To understand why the brain fails so spectacularly at recognizing its own manipulation, the researchers dive into the deep end of cognitive science. We have to look at the neuroscience of agency.
The paper dissects the feeling of agency, the subjective, internal experience that I am the author of this action, and reveals that it is not a monolithic sensation.
Okay.
It is not a switch that is either on or off. Agency is a highly complex, fragile construct built from the continuous interplay of two distinct cognitive mechanisms, predictive processes and postdictive processes.
It sounds like predictive mechanisms are our brain acting as a fortune teller. It's the brain generating an expectation of what the coffee cup will feel like before we even touch it.
Right.
So if that's the setup, postdictive must be the brain playing detective after the fact, looking at the result and reverse engineering a reason why we did it.
That is an excellent framework. Let's delve into the predictive side first. When you decide to initiate an action, say reaching for that coffee cup, your brain's motor cortex sends a command to your arm. But simultaneously, it generates what neuroscientists call an efference copy, or a forward model.
Efference copy.
Well, it predicts the sensory consequences of the impending action. It predicts the trajectory of your arm, the tactile sensation of the ceramic, the visual input of the cup moving. When the actual sensory feedback arrives and matches that internal prediction, the brain's comparator mechanism registers a match and generates the feeling of agency.
I predicted X, X occurred, therefore I caused X.
Exactly.
The expectation aligns with reality, so the brain takes credit. But what happens when the predictive model is weak or non-existent? That's where the detective work comes in. Exactly. When predictive signals are unavailable or noisy, the brain relies heavily on postdictive inferences. It analyzes the outcome of the action, looks back at its general intentions, and infers agency after the event has concluded.
Give me an example.
So, my hand moved, the cup was lifted, I generally enjoy coffee, therefore I must have intended to lift the cup. It is an inference drawn from the results, heavily biased by a desire to view oneself as a rational, goal-oriented actor.
I want to use an analogy to solidify this for everyone, because the interplay between these two mechanisms is the exact vulnerability magicians exploit.
Okay.
Imagine you are at an arcade playing a complex racing video game. Unbeknownst to you, the arcade cabinet is broken, your steering wheel is unplugged, and the screen is just playing a pre-recorded video of a perfect race.
A classic illusion of control scenario.
Right. So you see a sharp turn coming up on the screen. You intend to turn left, and you crank the unplugged steering wheel to the left. That intention, that motor command, is your predictive mechanism firing. Coincidentally, the pre-recorded video on the screen shows the car executing a flawless left turn at that exact millisecond.
Mm-hmm.
That visual feedback is your postdictive evidence,
mm-hmm.
because your predictive intention and the postdictive visual outcome align perfectly in time. Your brain instantly wires those two events together. It generates a massive, undeniable feeling of agency. You think, wow, I nailed that turn, even though you had absolutely zero causal input into the system.
Exactly.
The wires between intention and outcome were completely severed, but your brain stitched them together anyway.
That analogy perfectly encapsulates the structural methodology of a magic trick. The context of forcing purposefully downplays, disrupts, or entirely bypasses the predictive processes, forcing the brain to rely almost exclusively on flawed postdictive inferences.
Wow.
Magicians meticulously engineer environments where your internal predictions are either irrelevant or impossible to make accurately.
Let's apply that to the forces we've discussed. How does the unplugged arcade cabinet apply to something like the Darren Brown mental priming routine?
Well, in a decision force like mental priming, the spectator has no direct conscious access to the actual cognitive processes that are preceding their choice.
Because they're subconscious.
Exactly. The primes, the subtle gestures forming a diamond, the semantic emphasis on the number three are processed subconsciously. Because the true predictive causes of the thought are hidden from the conscious mind, the brain cannot build an accurate forward model.
It's blind.
Yes. When the thought of the three of diamonds suddenly pops into their head, the brain lacks the predictive data to understand why. So it falls back on postsynaptic rationalization. It confabulates.
Right.
I thought of the three of diamonds because red is a vibrant color and three is a prime number. They postdictively invent agency because they were blind to the predictive nudges.
And outcome forces attack from the other direction.
Yeah.
If decision forces hide the predictive causes, outcome forces scramble the postdictive evidence.
Precisely. Outcome forces take advantage of the fact that spectators cannot accurately predict the actual outcome of their choice.
Right.
In the crisscross force, you do not know the identity of the face-down card you're cutting to. In the equivoque, you do not know the semantic rules of the game until after you have touched an object.
Right, the ambiguity.
Because a reliable prediction is impossible, the brain's comparator mechanism is starved of data. It becomes entirely dependent on the magician's postdictive framing.
The magician tells you what it meant.
The magician tells you what your action meant after the fact you chose the key. And your brain, lacking any strong predictive data to contradict that narrative, simply absorbs the new reality. It is a complete hijacking of the post hoc inference system.
It's staggering to realize how fragile the illusion of our own control really is. The brain is just frantically stitching together intentions and outcomes, desperately trying to author a coherent story of self-determination. And the magician is just casually snipping the threads and tying them somewhere else.
And this fragility is not uniform across the population, which raises a fascinating area for future research, highlighted by Pallas and Kuhn.
Really? Some people are more vulnerable.
Oh, definitely. Magicians have long known about responsive spectators, individuals who are naturally more susceptible to forcing. Future cognitive studies will likely map these individual differences against specific psychological parameters.
Yes, what?
While they will investigate traits like need for cognition, which measures how much an individual enjoys engaging in deep analytical system two thinking.
Okay.
They will look at locus of control, determining whether a person believes they internally control their life or if external forces dictate outcomes. They will even correlate susceptibility to forces with hypnotic suggestibility to see if the neural pathways governing compliance are shared.
That is fascinating.
Understanding these individual variances will provide an even more detailed schematic of how human agencies is constructed and how easily it can be dismantled.
Which brings us to the final and undoubtedly the most vital part of our deep dive. The laboratory in Goldsmith's and the stage of a magic show are highly controlled, bounded environments.
Yeah.
We step into those spaces with a tacit agreement that our perception will be challenged. But the cognitive vulnerabilities we are discussing, the visual processing blind spots, the biomechanical laziness, the ambiguity blindness, the reliance on flawed postdictive inferences, these are not confined to the theater.
No, they're not.
These are the fundamental operating mechanics of the human brain. And they are functioning in completely unscripted, high-stakes environments every single day.
This is the pivot from theoretical psychology to applied ethics. The final section of the paper deals explicitly with the real-world implications of covertly manipulating choice. The authors note that the principles underpinning forcing are ubiquitous in modern society.
Ubiquitous.
We can begin by examining the more benign or at least openly debated applications, such as the behavioral economics concept of nudging.
Nudging is essentially the practice of designing the architecture of choice to subtly encourage certain behaviors without outright restricting a person's freedom.
Right.
The paper specifically mentions using these psychological principles to encourage better decisions regarding public health and individual well-being.
The architecture of a supermarket is the most tangible example of this theory in action. The layout of the shelves utilizes the exact same principles of visual saliency and the path of least resistance as the visual riffle force and the position force.
Really?
Absolutely. When a store deliberately places healthy items, fresh produce, whole grains at eye level and within easy reach, they dramatically increase the probability that shoppers will select those items over less healthy options placed on the bottom shelf.
Oh, wow.
The biomechanical exploitation is identical to placing the target card in the third position from the left.
The path of least resistance.
Yes. The shopper places the apples in their cart and feels an internal sense of agency. I decided to eat healthier today, while remaining entirely unaware that the physical geometry of the store heavily curated that specific outcome.
It's the position force applied to nutrition. And we see similar applications in digital entertainment. Video game designers and interactive media creators utilize Equivoque-style dialogue trees.
Oh, definitely.
They present the player with what feels like a multitude of distinct choices, creating a deep sense of immersion and autonomy. Hmm. But structurally, all those varied choices funnel the player back to the same predetermined narrative bottleneck.
Right.
The creator delivers a tightly paced story without having to program infinite branching storylines, and the player experiences the emotional high of feeling like the master of their own destiny.
And those applications are generally viewed as mutually beneficial or benign. However, Palis and Kuhn issue a very stark warning regarding the darker applications of these principles.
This is the important part.
The covert control and modification of human thought and decision-making raises profound ethical dilemmas when the goals of the architect do not align with the well-being of the subject. Magicians are entertainers, but they are not the only entities utilizing these techniques.
So what does this all mean for us as citizens and consumers? We have just spent the last hour documenting a vast toolbox of psychological hacks. These tools bypass conscious awareness, manipulate physical biases, utilize conversational priming, exploit our desire to avoid social friction, and fundamentally hijack the brain's internal mechanisms for assigning authorship to our own actions.
That's a lot.
When you take that exact toolbox out of the hands of an entertainer and put it into the hands of a political campaign, a multinational corporation, or an algorithmic social media platform, you are no longer looking at magic. You are looking at the structural mechanics of modern propaganda.
And I want to be very clear here. It is absolutely crucial to analyze this through a structural lens rather than an ideological one.
Yes, very important.
The paper emphasizes that the efficacy of propaganda relies heavily on the exact cognitive vulnerabilities exposed by magicians. And it is vital to understand that these psychological tactics are structural realities of the human brain. They are utilized relentlessly across the entire political spectrum.
By everyone. By both left-wing and right-wing entities, by democratic campaigns and authoritarian regimes alike, we aren't taking any sides here. The analysis here is strictly about the method of information delivery, entirely independent of the specific content or ideological viewpoint being transmitted.
Let's tie the method back to the magic. When a political figure or a media outlet utilizes heavily emotionally charged, deliberately vague language, they are not just speaking poorly. They are actively deploying ambiguity blindness.
Yeah.
They want the listener to project their own preferred meaning, their own fears or hopes, onto the statement, exactly like the spectator assigning their own meaning to the act of touching the wallet in the Equivoque. The speaker claims the outcome regardless of the interpretation.
The parallels are direct. Consider the modern media landscape. When digital platforms and news algorithms bombard users with specific, highly curated imagery, artificially increasing the visual saliency of certain narratives while suppressing the visibility of counter-narratives, they are executing the visual riffle force on a societal scale. They do not need to explicitly instruct the user on what to believe. They simply curate the visual and informational environment so that the user's System 1 heuristics naturally, almost inevitably, lead them to the desired conclusion.
And because the user arrived at that conclusion without feeling overtly coerced, because the platform merely altered the path of least resistance, the user's postdictive agency mechanisms kick into overdrive.
Exactly.
They fiercely defend the implanted belief because they genuinely, biologically feel that it was the result of their own free, uninfluenced logical deduction. The propaganda becomes invisible, precisely because the brain has claimed ownership of the manipulated thought. It is confabulation weaponized on a mass scale.
Which leads directly to the author's conclusion. Palis and Kuhn argue that studying the mechanisms of magic tricks is not merely a niche academic exercise in cognitive psychology. It is a vital, necessary tool for public defense.
Public defense.
You cannot defend against a cognitive force if you lack the vocabulary to identify it. By rigorously understanding how our blind spots are mapped and exploited by entertainers, we develop the critical literacy required to recognize when those exact same routines are being run on us by algorithms, marketers, or political entities.
Right.
It is about forcing policymakers and society at large to take the reality of cognitive manipulation seriously in an era where our attention, our data, and our choices are constantly commodified.
It has been an incredibly dense, slightly terrifying, and wildly illuminating journey today. We started by defining the seemingly impossible criteria of a magical force, controlling a choice while perfectly preserving the illusion of complete freedom. Mm-hmm. We broke down decision forces, realizing that our biomechanical laziness and visual processing shortcuts make us highly predictable targets, and that subtle conversational primes can drastically alter the statistical probability of the thoughts popping into our heads.
We did.
We examined outcome forces, where semantic traps and the decay of working memory render our genuinely free choices entirely meaningless. We dove deep into the neuroscience, seeing how our brain's predictive expectations and postdictive rationalizations can be easily unplugged, scrambled, and rewired.
Right.
And finally, we confronted the reality that these cognitive illusions are the invisible architecture shaping our daily lives.
The research fundamentally challenges the baseline narrative of how we perceive our interactions with the world. It requires a constant, rigorous reevaluation of our own autonomy.
It really does. So I'm going to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you step back into the world. Tomorrow morning, when you reach for that specific brand of coffee, or you click on an article that perfectly aligns with your worldview, or you decide which route to drive to work,
just take a moment.
Take a moment. Pause the autopilot. Ask yourself, did you genuinely independently author that choice from scratch? Or did the environment simply deal you a metaphorical key and wallet and you just fell for the equivoke? The truly scary part of this research isn't that we are constantly influenced. The scary part is that the influence feels exactly like freedom. Keep questioning the architecture of your choices, flex that system to muscle, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.